Good morning, everyone. Hope you're doing well this Sunday morning. We've been in this passage of Matthew, this section of the Gospel of Matthew, where we're looking at the last week of Jesus' life before he is crucified. It's kind of leading up to Easter. And the last couple weeks, I think, have, if you've been here, have shown us some different aspects. You've looked at things a little bit differently. Last week with Mark here, looking at communion from a little bit different perspective. And hopefully, for me, for you, hopefully, this has kind of helped you see things maybe in a way that you haven't considered before. Today, we're going to continue that in Matthew chapter 26, looking at a couple scenes where Jesus faces the issue of betrayal. Betrayal, if that sounds like a pretty dramatic word for you, I know it's something we all kind of face at different phases in life, but if it sounds a little bit too dramatic for you at this moment, just kind of think back to maybe being a kid. Maybe there was this moment that you had. I feel like I can kind of remember this season where, like, as a young kid, you're with your parents, you're just willing to tell the truth, like everything's the truth, and then there's like this moment where you discover like lying. You discover this thing in where other kids around you on the playground are start lying. And maybe as a parent, you're kind of like, we're in that phase right now with our kids. Like they were fine, everything was good. We could ask them anything and we get a true response back, and now they've discovered this idea of falsehood. Maybe you've been at like a dinner party or with friends and you've played games and the entire premise of the game is around falsehood, that you have to lie, that you have to convince other people that the thing you're saying that isn't true actually is true and here's why they need to believe you. And so when we think about betrayal, yes, there are pretty extreme examples and maybe you've been affected by fairly extreme examples of that, but there are also smaller examples where this idea of this violation of trust happens. And we can kind of live with betrayal in a couple different ways, I think. We can kind of live with it in such a way that, like, we kind of keep it at arm's length, or we think we can keep it at arm's length. We think we can make it a game, maybe not literally speaking, but figuratively speaking. But we also know the impact of betrayal. We know that betrayal wounds us, that there are wounds created from betrayal. And I think what happens when those wounds occur to us, what happens when we move kind of beyond maybe these what we would consider simple things or games or some of these things, but when we start facing this idea of betrayal, we start facing the wounds that happen in us, we start kind of living a couple different ways. One, I think we live in such a way that we start to believe a narrative. We start to believe maybe that the world is rigged to harm us. Maybe you've faced betrayal, maybe someone's violated trust in a certain way against you, and you've started to believe a narrative that, like, hey, this is the way the world works. This is the way everyone is. I'm just going to keep everyone at a distance from me. We start to believe a narrative that the world is rigged for our harm rather than for our growth. The other thing we can tend to do with betrayal is that we can start to find a way that our wounds are in such a deep part of our heart that our reaction to any kind of potential betrayal going forward is to fight. You know, we're going to do anything we can not to let that happen to me again. I don't ever want to feel that again. So anyone who like kind of starts to go that way with me, I'm going to get them before they get me. And so life becomes this kind of like who wins situation. You get this like incredibly defensive. You like, I've got to defeat you rather than work with you and live in community alongside you. And I bring all this up, and I realize this is a bit heavy to going into, but I bring all this up because Jesus faced betrayal. I mean, a lot of times we can hear the story of Jesus, even if you're not familiar with the story of Jesus, you kind of picture Jesus like kind of with those European kind of looks where he's kind of serene all day long. It's like, no, hold on. Actually, Jesus faced betrayal. And Jesus knew what it was like to experience the wounds of betrayal. Jesus knew the moments that you know in your life. He knew the heartache of it. And what Jesus did, what's so interesting and what we're going to see today, is that Jesus acted differently. And Jesus called the people, his close followers in this day, and I think to us today, to a new kind of way. A way that I think as you're going to see today, as we're going to see today, he offers two calls that kind of go on the other side of betrayal and help us move through it to something better on the other side. So that's what we're going to see today in Matthew chapter 26. We're going to be in verse 31. We're going to see how Jesus faced betrayal what he called his followers to, two actions that he called them to. And I think as we take these in, that maybe could change how you and I interact in our relationships and our environments here today as well. But this passage, these three passages we're going to look at, they start with this tension of betrayal that I think you'll resonate with. It kind of plays out between Jesus and Peter in this first passage, verse 31, chapter 26 of Matthew. It'll be on the screen above me as well. So this is after the Passover meal that we talked about last week. Here, verse 31, Jesus tells him, "This very night you will all fall away on account of me." So you're all going to betray me. You're all going to leave, for it is written, and here he quotes the Old Testament. He quotes some of the prophets. He says, "I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." And then Jesus goes on and says, "But after I've risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Peter replies, "Even if all fall away on account of you, I never will." "Truly, I tell you," Jesus answered, "this very night, Peter, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." And Peter says, no. "Even if I have to die, I will never disown you." And all the other disciples said the same thing too. So at the beginning of this, we see the tension of betrayal, that Jesus says, hey, betrayal is going to be part of his story. There's going to be something that happens to him, and it's going to happen to him by his closest friends. Maybe you've been in a place like that. Maybe you've had a friend where, like, maybe you gave them a piece of information, and they shared that inappropriately, and you're like, hey, that hurt our relationship. Maybe that you had a friend that you depended on, they let you down, and you know what this is like. And Jesus is like, hey, all of you who have been with me for 3 years, you've been following me, we've been together on this thing, we've been traveling, you've seen all that God's doing through me, all of you are going to betray me tonight. All of you are going to walk away. Jesus says, this is going to be part of the story of what's about to happen. The other side, that's one side of the tension. The other side of it is what Peter exclaims is that he's like, even if everyone else, which has got to be kind of an awkward moment because they're all standing there, Peter's like, hey, everyone else is going to fall away but me. He kind of steps forward a little bit. But he says, even if everyone else, I never will. The other side of the tension of betrayal is that, yes, we maybe know that betrayal is going to be part of the story, but we think we're impervious to it. We think we can stand beyond it. We think we're different than all the others. And you're like, Peter, the same humanity that's plaguing them is plaguing you. No, but I'm going to be different. I'm going to be different. The tension of betrayal is that's part of the story, and yet we feel like we can escape it. We feel like we can stand above it. We can stand beyond it. And Jesus is kind of like, no, Peter, you don't understand. You're going to be part of that as well. But I love how Jesus responds, because he kind of paints the picture of what's coming. He paints the picture even beyond Easter. He says this, that he will go ahead of them. That's verse 32. "After I've risen, I will go ahead of you." This is language of like what a shepherd does. A shepherd goes ahead of his sheep. In fact, the Gospel of John, in John chapter 10, Jesus says this very thing, that a shepherd goes ahead of his sheep. Jesus is using language of grace. He's using language of care. He's saying, even though you're going to betray me, I'm going to go ahead of you. I'm going to lead the way forward to something better. Grace goes ahead. That's what Jesus is saying. He's embodying that grace goes ahead. Grace takes the first step. Grace takes the initiative. Even when there's hurt, grace says, no, but I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to find a way to the other side through betrayal. Grace goes ahead and is calling them to something better on the other side. Jesus didn't say, hey, you're all going to betray me and then we're done. He says, you're all going to betray me, but I'm going to go ahead of you. He's calling them to something better, something more. We see this call in these next two scenes of what happens as they enter what is the Garden of Gethsemane. And he issues, I think, two calls to his disciples in this. And the first call, it takes place, is a call to stay awake. This is verse 36. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him. We're kind of like the three closest of the closest with him. And he said, and he took them with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed and with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here, keep watch, stay awake with me." Going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed to his father. He said, "My father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. The very thing, he just wanted them just to stay awake, and they're betraying him already. They're sleeping. He says, "Couldn't you keep watch with me for an hour?" He asked Peter, which I love that we throw that in. Peter, the one who just said, "Don't worry, I'm with you," except when I'm asleep, apparently. "But I'm with you." He says, "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. For the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Jesus went away a second time, prayed, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Then he returned to these disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping? Look, the hour has come. The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Jesus issues a call. He takes his three closest with him in this moment of sorrow, this moment as he's looking ahead to the cross and to what will be asked of him. And he says, "Look, I just need you to stay awake." It's a call to stay awake, which on one level is this call to comfort. It's this call for them to comfort Jesus. Like, he's sorrowful. He's in time of incredible distress. And he's saying, "Look, you're the three closest. You're of all the closest. You're like my closest friends. Can you just be with me?" Maybe you've had seasons like that where you're just like, "You know what? I don't need advice. I don't need input. I just need a couple people who will just be with me, who will just stand alongside me during this next season." I don't think Jesus is asking too much of them. It's like, "Can you just stay with me just for a little bit as I try to process this sorrow?" So this call to stay awake is a call to comfort Jesus as he seeks the comfort of his heavenly Father. I think this call, though, to stay awake is also a call for them. It's a call of adjustment. It's a call of them adjusting their interior world, adjusting their heart to the holy presence of the Spirit. Here's what I mean by that. Jesus tells them to stay awake, to not fall into temptation, which I find it always to be an interesting line. I'm like, they're in an olive grove. Like, what kind of temptation? Like, "More olives, please. Like, don't eat too much." No. He's obviously not talking about the olive trees and what may happen. He's talking about something more in them. This is a call for them to stay awake, is a call for them to be renewed, to be made new. That Jesus is saying, like, there's stuff that's going on all around you. There's stuff that's about to happen that's going to impact who you are. You need to stay awake to this. You need to stay awake to what God is doing all around you. Apparently the disciples, and particularly these three, had a problem with this. Back in the Gospel of Luke, there's this moment called the Transfiguration where Jesus is like transformed as this heavenly moment on earth. And these three, same three, are with Jesus. And what do they do in that moment? They fall asleep. I don't know why he keeps taking these three, but he keeps taking them and they keep falling asleep at these moments where they need to stay awake, aware that God is doing something all around them and that God has something for them. So it's a call of Jesus, a call of grace for them to stay awake, for them to be aware that God is doing something in them, that God is renewing them, that God's building a new narrative. It's a narrative that starts with them adjusting their way of being to the way of God. One theologian from the 20th century put this, I think, so well. He said grace, this call of grace, this idea of grace that we see here in this picture that Jesus is calling them to. Grace introduces a new problem. If you've never thought about grace introducing a problem, grace introduces a new problem. It is the problem of the adjustment of the heart to the holy presence of the Spirit and of maintaining the unbroken attitude of dependence on Him. Jesus' call of grace, their call of grace to stay awake, is a call for them to adjust, to them to be made new, to be aware that a new narrative all around them, the holy presence of the Spirit, is at work all around them. Grace is calling them to something different, and Jesus models this for them. Jesus goes in His distress, in His heartache, and His action in that moment is to seek His Heavenly Father. He models this passion for the Holy Presence. And He says this statement that quite well known, that as you, yet not as I will, but as You will. That's not, doesn't mean an absence of desire. It doesn't mean that Jesus doesn't feel. We're told He's deeply grieving. This is not someone who's checked all of His emotions at the door. This is someone who says, you know what, God, I don't know if I can go through with this, but if this is what You want, I will follow Your lead. It's one who's passionate for the Holy Presence. It's one who's modeling this call to His closest followers. So Jesus, the first call that He gives to His disciples is to stay awake, to be aware, to adjust to the Holy Presence of the Spirit, that there's a new narrative, that the narratives we've tended to believe about betrayal, we can put those aside for a new kind of way, a new narrative. And the second call that Jesus gives these guys is a call to put away the sword. Here comes this scene. It's a fascinating scene. After in verse 47, while He's still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. Judas, the one who betrayed Him. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed Him. Jesus replied, "Do what you came for, friend." Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested Him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Put your sword back in its place," Jesus said, "for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think that I cannot call on My Father, and He will at once put at My disposal more than 12 legions of angels, at 72,000 angels? But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen this way?" In that hour, Jesus said to the crowd, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture Me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest Me. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled." Then all the disciples deserted Him and fled. Jesus' second call is to put away the sword. The scene, it starts in an interesting way. Like, it starts with this like aggressive move, which if we saw a movie of these couple scenes together, there's like a bit of serenity, and then there's this aggressive move by Judas. It's almost like he comes with this small army, which is really kind of a bit absurd. It's a bit of an absurd show of force. And Jesus says so. He's like, "Why are you coming with all these people? You've seen Me every day. I'm just one guy." Like, this is, though, you get this sense, like, this is how Judas understands power. Like, this is how Judas understands how the world works. It's like, you've got to be more powerful than the other person. You've got to win. And so Judas thinking, well, Jesus, and I don't know what I believe about Jesus, but I at least believe He's got some sort of power, so I'm not just going to come with just me and one other guy with handcuffs. We're going to bring a small army. We're going to bring weapons. And there's kind of this almost, like, silliness about it all. Because, like, Jesus, like, well, look, if this is really about a confrontation, this thing would be over and snap at My finger. But this is how Judas understands power, that power is to be leveraged to win, to conquer someone else. And so there's one of Jesus' followers who seems to get that clue, and so he pulls a sword. And one of the other gospel writers, John, identifies this person as Peter. Which is, if that's true, again, the irony is pretty rich through these stories, that Peter, the one who says, I'm above betrayal. I'm not going to be affected by that, Jesus. You can count on me to be above the fray, is the one who's the first to lash out. Ever been there? Ever been there where like, I'm not going to deal with this. If there's ever any conflict, I know exactly what I'm going to do. If anyone ever wrongs me, I know exactly what I'm going to do. And then you're the first one to lash out. Like, Peter, no, you don't get this. You're part of the problem like the rest of us. You're perpetuating this. But Peter, in a lot of ways, in pulling out the sword, really does what all of us think we should do when there's betrayal. We think we pull out a sword. We think we have to rectify the wrong that's been done to us. We think we have to fight back. We think that the way forward is to make sure this never happens to us again. Let's pull out a sword and let's start with that. We are all, like Peter, people of swords. Which then makes Jesus' statement all that more powerful. He says, put your sword back in its place. There's a place for it. It's not now. He says, put it back. This isn't a story, in essence, Jesus is saying to Peter. This isn't a time. This isn't a story. This isn't a situation about confrontation. This isn't about who wins. Because again, this could be over in a second. There is something else going on. And he says it there twice, like that this is something that God's fulfilling a story. God's doing something behind the scenes, Peter, that you don't see. This is about the purposes of God being fulfilled. To put the sword back in its place is a call to a different way of living. It's a call to putting down our need to fight to win. It's a call back to the garden of prayer. It says, not my will, but yours be done. That you, God, have a better way. Jesus says, put the sword back in its place. And then Jesus kind of uses this turn of phrase, which I find fascinating too. He says to the crowd in verse 55, he says, am I leading a rebellion? The word there is this is a word that was used for a revolutionary or a rebel. He's like, am I a rebel? Am I a revolutionary? You think I'm trying to turn this whole thing over? To which we kind of go, actually, he kind of is. He is like trying to change how we interact and how we live in the world. But it's not a revolution like they're thinking, where the armies have to go against the armies and let's see who's going to win. Jesus is starting this revolution of grace. That there's a different way to live. There's a different way to interact. There's a different way to move forward in the world. It's a revolution based on grace. What's interesting is that same word for revolutionary is the same word, same title for the two men that are crucified on either side of Jesus. They were rebels. They were revolutionaries. That's why they were captured and killed by Rome. You kind of go, oh, Jesus was crucified next to two rebels. And you kind of go look at it again. It's like, well, maybe there were three rebels. Maybe there were actually three revolutionaries. Jesus is changing how the world works. He's offering a new way forward. That how people interact is maybe a call to something better. He calls them to stay awake. He calls them to believe a new narrative, that there's an adjustment to the holy presence of the Spirit, that God's doing something in them and around them that they haven't seen. And there's also a call to put away the sword. To give up their right to win and to say, not my will, but yours be done. It's a story of grace. It's a picture of grace. That in the midst of betrayal, the way that Jesus responds is grace. Not just sits back, but engages in ways that no one else does. Could you imagine if you did that? Can you imagine the next time you face betrayal that you act in a way that no one expects? Because everyone pulls a sword out. Everyone starts to believe a new narrative. Everyone says, well, those people are out to harm me. That person's dangerous. Everyone says, look, I've got to fight so this never happens to me again. I'm going to come aggressive next time so I don't get sideswiped. What if there's a different way? What if there's a new way forward? As the New Testament writers, the followers of Jesus think about this, and they think about the way Jesus faced betrayal and going to the cross and dying. They say this very thing. They draw this contrast. Paul, to the church in Romans, says it this way. He's like, where sin increases, where sin is life outside of the design of God, it's this betrayal of who God has created us to be. He says where that kind of flourishes, you know what flourishes against it? Grace. Where sin has increased, where you and I start to fight against the ways that God has designed us to be, God's response is not to pull out another sword. God's response is grace, to call us to something better. And you say, well, I can get that. Maybe I can get my mind around that. Maybe you can get your mind around that. Maybe someone's told you that, like, that's true, that there's that God's offered you grace in response to sin, to your life outside of his design. But maybe in your mind you think, well, there's an end to that. Because I know what it's like to be gracious, but I also know when my grace reaches its end. And it's like God's different, though. Whenever you feel like grace is about at the end, there's still more grace. And James, I believe, says it this way. He says in James chapter 4, he says he gives us more grace. So when you think you're at the end of grace, there's more. When you think God's exhausted his grace for you, there's more. When you think there's no reason that person should get anything from God, no, there's more for them as well. And so you and I are called to a life that models that more, that models more grace and calls people to a different way of living. Yes, anyone can believe a narrative that the world is rigged to harm us. Anyone can pull out a sword. Not everyone does this. Not everyone lives this way. Not everyone lives in such a way that there's more grace and believes there's even more. And when you get to the point, you're like, I don't even know how I'm going to live in response to betrayal like you lived in response to betrayal, Jesus. And all you hear back from, just trust me, there's more. There's more for you. There's more for that person. There's more. I'm sitting over this with more grace, and there's more, and there's more. He gives more. And when life gets out of control and sin increases, there's grace that's increasing alongside of it. You're never alone in this. You're never by yourself in this. There's more. And when you think you're too far gone, here is God, Jesus, the person of God personified, who goes ahead of you. And if Jesus goes ahead of you, grace goes ahead of you. So you're always following grace. You're always following the trail of grace. There's always more for you. So maybe the question for you, the question for me as we end this morning is, what is grace calling you into? What is grace transforming in you? Maybe you resonate with the call to stay awake. Maybe in you something has gotten off track. Maybe there's this sense where you're like, you've fallen asleep and God's been like doing things around you and you've fallen asleep and then something else happened and you fell asleep and something in you needs to change. Maybe you resonate with that quote, the idea of an adjustment to the holy presence of the Spirit. Maybe the call of grace for you is to move towards a change, a renewal in you. Maybe the call that you resonate with is to put away your sword. Maybe you live in such a way in this world with among your friends, your relationships, that your response is just like Peter. I'm above all of this, and if anyone comes at me, I'm ready to go. And you pull out a sword, and you pull out a sword, and you pull out a sword, all in this pursuit to not be betrayed and not realizing you're perpetuating this all around you. You're perpetuating the pain that you don't want to feel. You're perpetuating this everywhere you go. And so maybe the call for you, the call of grace, is to put away your sword and say, you know what? There's got to be a better way. And God, I'm going to start with you. That not my will, but yours be done. Yeah, it's going to be an act of faith. And maybe there's something better. Maybe he's writing a new story. Maybe when you put away that sword and put it back in its place, you see a narrative of grace all around you that you never saw before because you were so quick to pull out the sword. Grace goes before. Jesus goes before. And when Jesus goes before, then he's calling you through whatever you're facing. You're not facing it alone. There is more grace, and he gives more. And when you feel like you've exhausted it, there's even more. He's calling you to the something on the other side. I find it so interesting, just as we close, like that last statement. Then all the disciples deserted him and fled. We started with this kind of exposition of betrayal, and you get to the end of it all, like kind of hoping, like, yeah, they're going to stick around. I mean, like, especially Peter, he was so bold and confident. And the story ends, they're gone. And the next time, I think that for most of them, they see Jesus is up on the cross. I wonder what that did in them. I wonder what it was like at some point, maybe after the cross, maybe after the resurrection, where it started to click for them. Oh, in the midst of the moment where we betrayed him, he displayed grace. And they had a picture, an image, an act that they could never live up to, but constantly was calling them to something better. This beautiful picture of grace. There's grace for you with Jesus. Maybe you're here today and you've never made a decision to follow Jesus. Maybe today, as you talk with people, as we have our prayer team down here and back there later, as someone that you meet out in the lobby, maybe you could talk with them about that. Maybe you've gotten to a place in your story where you feel like you've exhausted all the grace of God. And maybe you need to talk with someone and have them retell the story, retell you a new narrative that there is more. There's more grace. Maybe people have wronged you, that you viewed the world in such a way that's rigged for your harm. And you need to hear again, no, there's more grace. This is a narrative of grace. I'm going to pray for us, and then we're going to sing again about the faithfulness of God to remind ourselves of this story. And I want to take a few moments and pray for you. Whatever story you've brought in here, wherever this story takes you from here, as you interact with this personally, as you interact with this as a family, as you interact with this as friends, that you would hear more grace for you. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for your grace. That in the midst of a world where we carry the scars of betrayal, that we feel like we have to fight for ourselves, where we've believed a narrative that the world is out to harm us, that you've said a different thing. You've told us a different narrative. You've offered a new way forward. Thank you for the example of Jesus as he faced heartache, as he's faced betrayal, that we just tend to read over and ignore what he may have been experiencing emotionally, relationally. Thank you for his example, that we're not alone, that he models for us and calls us to something better. God, I pray for those in this room who have lost the ability of grace in their relationships. I pray, God, that you would renew them by the holy presence of your Spirit, that they would be people who offer more grace because they believed a new narrative today. Pray for those in this room, God, who pull out a sword where a betrayal has deeply wounded them, and their now response is to fight everyone around them, that you would give them the grace to put the sword back in its place. God, would we be people, whatever story we brought in here, that we trust, that we can say, not my approach to this, but yours. And we can lean on your faithfulness. That in the times we feel like we've exhausted your grace, your faithfulness is new every day. And there's more. There's more grace for us today. Thank you for that gift in Jesus and what he displayed on the cross. We celebrate that. We look to that as we seek to live that kind of life here.